senses will rise. For the flowers of the city, though breath like it, death like some time. And there's no use in
That's the great song To Ramona by Bob Dylan from his album Another Side of Bob Dylan, which he recorded on this day in 1964, probably one of his greatest works. The album, I mean. I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all here with us on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're going to take a look now at what happened in the G7 summit that took place in Bavaria and get from many different perspectives kind of looking at what transpired there. They tackled so much. From the need to keep the European Union alive to what's going on with Greece to the trade partnerships. But most importantly, I think you saw the kind of confrontation with Russia escalating in a number of ways, and the announcements they made about climate change to get rid of the use of fossil fuels by the year 2100 to talking about ISIS and bringing to the table in some strange ways, some people might argue, the presence of Iraq in Nigeria. To talk to them about that, and Tunisia. We are joined here right now by Michael Vaquero, who is a correspondent for Al Jazeera America. And Michael, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Great to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
And now Gardner is with us, who is director of the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at Heritage Foundation. Good to have you with us, Niall.
Yes, hello there.
And Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies, Senior Analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus, author of Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace. And he blogs at peace.com. And Adil, welcome back. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts and ideas. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. But do call in with your thoughts on what's been going on at the summit at 410-319-8888. Let's just begin with what our kind of overall analysis, Michael Vaquero, let me start with you. I mean, because people are making a great deal of this, this summit as being groundbreaking, and I'm wondering if you thought that if that analysis rings true and holds true.
You know, I think it was more of a steady ground. I think the president had a mission when he went to the Bavarian town outside of Munich, and it was more to just than to have a beer and some Weisswurst on Sunday. You may have seen those pictures.
Yeah.
He wanted, number one, to keep the allies in line when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. Now another flare-up in eastern Ukraine. Everyone but Russia pointing the fingers at the Russian-backed separatists there. Of course, Crimea remains now part of Russia for all intents and purposes. And if you recall, last year at about this time, when the G8 became the G7, because Vladimir Putin and Russia had effectively been banished on account of their actions in Ukraine, the president was trying very hard, it was in Brussels, I was there, to get everyone on board, the Europeans who have much more skin in the game in terms of the economic integration with Russia, to come across with some very stringent sanctions that would more or less compel Russia to reverse course. The allies came up with those sanctions. They've maintained a somewhat unified front up until now, but some of the sanctions were due to expire, and the president wanted to make sure the allies were on board, and there was even a little saber-rattling about possible more sanctions if Russia does continue on its course, and it's showing no signs of abating now, notwithstanding the fact that, according to President Obama, the Russian economy is pretty much hit the skids here in no small part due to the sanctions. And the president wanted to hear, as you mentioned, from Haider al-Abadi. He had a bilateral with him, a one-on-one meeting, and some interesting comments from the president coming out of that, essentially saying that they want to train more Iraqi forces at a more rapid pace, but they're having trouble recruiting Iraqis. That's an ominous sign. And number one, the president was still formulating a policy, and words that have gained a little attention in the rhetorical and political realm, saying we don't quite have a policy. The policy isn't ready yet in Iraq as the Pentagon ponders whether to send more American trainers, which is obviously a slippery slope that the administration wants to avoid, Mark.
Niall, let me get your overall quick analysis here before I turn to Adil.
Well, my thoughts on the summit are that, you know, G7 summits like this don't generally achieve very much. I mean, they've become sort of talking shops, as it were, rather than forums for concrete policy action. I don't think this summit was any different in that in that respect. It was certainly, of course, overshadowed by the ongoing crisis in Ukraine in the form of the Russian invasion there. And we have seen, I think, behind the scenes, some splits in the Western alliance against Russia. For example, the German foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, believes that Russia should be brought back eventually into the G7. That's not the position of the United States or Great Britain. So certainly there are tensions between some on the German side and the British and the Americans, who are pushing for a far tougher sanctions regime against Russia. But I do think you have many countries in Europe that believe in a softer line against Moscow, which I think is extremely unfortunate. And there is a strong lobby within Germany that is pushing for a relaxation of the sanctions against Russia, which I think would send completely the wrong signal towards Moscow. Also, of course, the summit was heavily overshadowed by events in the Middle East with the advanced ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Unfortunately, I think that President Obama didn't really project much in the way of American leadership when it came to Iraq. When asked about whether or not the United States had a clear strategy for training Iraqi security forces in the face of ISIS, President Obama simply said that we have no strategy at the moment. And that is not the kind of message that you want to be projecting as a leader of the free world on the international stage. So I think a good deal of confusion being sent on the U.S. side with regards to the war against ISIS. And this is a time, I think, when the world is looking to the United States for strong, bold leadership in the face of the Islamist terrorists.
In Otto, let me let you jump in. I have very specific questions about both Russia and the ISIS conversations that took place at the G7. But let me let you have at your overall analysis. Otto?
Thank you, Mark. I think the G7 is the G7 wants to manage the world and convey to the populace at large that it is manageable situation, rather than there are fears from places like ISIS or Chechnya or Putin, of course, or other countries, and this is their way of coming every few years in order to portray that. I think the whole issue with Putin, in part, is our fault. Not all of it, but the majority still is a fault of Putin. We provoked Putin into those actions in part, not fully. So the outcome is the sanctions, in order to basically put some parameters around him. And he has done really well despite the sanctions. His economy is slightly damaged, but nevertheless, he is doing very well. His popularity is still over 80%. So I don't think it's going to work, because nationalism is very strong in Russia lately for a variety of reasons. Of course, I think President Obama, unfortunately, he says a lot of things. He should say a little less, especially about Middle East. It would have been much more helpful. And the optics of basically disrespecting Abadi, waiting for him, trying to get a word in, and he just ignored him with his back to him. It's just the optics looks bad for him and Abadi, the relationship.
And I'm sorry, Mara Jones, who from Caffeine TV and former Clinton White House staffer on international trade policy. I didn't realize you were already there, but Mara, welcome.
Oh, thank you. I was happy to listen, as I always am, so no worries.
You want to jump in real fast? I do have some very specific questions about Russia and about and the Middle East, but let me let you have a quick shot at this.
Well, I think what's interesting is that these meetings are only usually valuable to the extent that they are a part of advancing a larger agenda. And we have to remember that all of these institutions, from the G7 to the World Bank to even the United Nations, are creations of American foreign policy. They're not divorced from it. We've set them up to advance internationally a set of values that we believe in. And if you are a liberal internationalist, and I'm a liberal internationalist, and what that means is that I believe that there are a set of rules that ought to apply to everyone in the international community that focus on human rights and human dignity and the rule of law and a whole host of other things. Even though we don't always live up to those are what those institutions are designed to advance. And one of the criticisms of the Obama administration from both left and right is the inconsistency on those fronts, and also the lack to the unwillingness sometimes to use these fora to advance a clear set of goals and a clear agenda. And it seems to me that during this particular summit, one of the reasons why things were all over the map is because of less of an American presence in terms of willing to exercise its leadership in a way that we all feel good about. And in that power vacuum, there's going to be a lot of stumbling. And I think that we see that. And I think that we saw that on everything from Russia to climate change, and a whole host of other things. So we have to look at these meetings. We have to look at the G7 summit in the larger set of issues and where we are on all of these. Otherwise, it just seems an odd kind of gathering of world leaders at a mountain on a mountainside.
So let me get very specifically here, and I know that Niall and Michael have to leave in a couple of minutes. So let me just jump in with them first and come back to my other two guests, Adil and Amara. But one of the things, and you made a comment earlier, Niall, about President Obama said we have no strategy at the moment when coming to ISIS, and I think that's probably because that's true, because I think not just President Obama, the world doesn't have a strategy to deal with ISIS, and we may want him to have one and want them to have one, but one doesn't exist, partially because maybe we created this mess in the first place that allowed this disruption on the planet between our attacks on Libya and Iraq that have yielded what we're facing now. So I think that's probably a very true statement. The West doesn't know what to do, has no idea what to do.
Well, I think it's very clear that President Obama doesn't really know what to do with Iraq or indeed with Syria. There's been no Syria strategy.
But who does, is what I'm saying.
For many years. Well, that's a good point. I mean, I don't think any nation in the world has a clear-cut strategy. This is where U.S. leadership, of course, comes in. And the United States, as the world superpower, plays such an important role in shaping international events. At the moment, I do think that what you have with the White House is a culture of leading from behind, letting others perhaps take the lead on international affairs. But of course, there is no one who is in that position at the moment. And if you look at, for example, all of the European allies of the United States, I mean, they're waiting to see what the United States does in Iraq and Syria. And if the United States does not actually do anything, no one in Europe is going to do anything. And I think there's a real vacuum of leadership at the moment on the world stage. And that's a very serious situation. That's not good, I think, for international security if the United States is not prepared to lead.
So and Michael, let me jump back to you here in the same spirit. I mean, I think that given what has transpired in the last 15 years on this planet between the Middle East and the West, I think that we have helped create this morass, which is why President Barack Obama makes a statement like that, because they have no idea what to do.
Well, I think obviously you're right. I mean, ever since 2001 and then the Iraq invasion in 2003, that ground is well plowed. It, evidently, we're going over it again now in the nascent presidential campaign with Jeb Bush stumbling and Hillary Clinton with some questions yet to answer. I think it's evident what you're talking about, this thread is more evident in the last 5 years in the Middle East since the start of the Arab Spring. I mean, you look at what happened in Egypt. President Obama, by most accounts, justifiably judged to be late in calling for Mubarak to go. You look at what happened in Libya, when essentially the United States stepped aside to let a regional coalition take the lead. You can fast forward on through Syria now, 5 years into the civil war. One of the reasons that the president felt compelled to gather the Gulf countries and allies, the Sunni-led nations at Camp David last month, was because of anger about Syria, because he didn't follow through on his threat to punish Bashar al-Assad for crossing that chemical weapon red line. And now look at Saudi Arabia and what's happening in Yemen. I mean, to the extent that the administration encourages regional actors to take the lead, and they certainly do that, there are obvious pitfalls now, and sometimes they get more than they bargained for. We recall that as the Saudi air campaign bombing Yemen, got out of hand in terms of civilian casualties, in terms of no demonstrable or evident effect on the Houthis there. The United States was pushing the Saudis for a pause in the bombing. You know, what happens in the Middle East to a certain degree is, and I think we saw this because of the snubs, we saw around the GCC, the summit of Arab nations at Camp David, is that the administration says they want regional actors and power players to take the role, allies, to take the lead role in actions like we're seeing, and yet the United States wants to do a little backseat driving, and that engenders some resentment, and altogether, you know, it's far from clear whether the strategy is going to be evident. I think the evidence at this point, and granted it is an interim stage and things are very much in flux, is that it's got a long way to go.
Well, let me just say, first of all, before I turn to Adlan, back to Amara, Michael Vaquera and Niall Gardner. Michael from the Al Jazeera America, it does great work there, Niall Gardner from the Heritage Foundation. Thank you both so much for being with us. I know you both have to run. I thank you for taking part in the program.
Pleasure.
The
thank
first
you very
part
much.
Today. Bye. And Adil, let me just go to you and encourage people to join us here, 410-319-8888, and then jump back to Amara. I mean, it seems to me, just sticking with ISIS for a moment and what happened at G7, I mean, this in some ways is an unraveling that began with the war in Iraq, but maybe even began before that with the end of World War One. that we're seeing an unraveling of things that in Tunisia, not Tunisia so much, but in Libya, in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen, in Iraq. What I was trying to posit was, I don't think anyone has the answer, which is why President Barack Obama makes a statement like he made.
Well, it's even worse than that. Here we, all this is a result really, not all of it, but majority of it is due to the invasion of Iraq. We have shaken that structure of the Arab nations by the invasion of Iraq arbitrarily, as they saw it. Even now, the architect of the invasion, militarily at least, not policy-wise maybe, Donald Rumsfeld said it was an error. So what happened now, Obama came with the promise of being more democratic, more peaceful. Well, what he's end up with, which is really unfortunate, I voted for him twice, he supports now the worst dictators, the worst corrupt regime, and they represent nobody but themselves, the Saudis, the Qataris, all the Gulf states, the Egyptians. Look where we end up. I mean, what's happened to that whole area? So he has two principles, and both principles, one, that is, he will not send troops, even though he keeps sending a lot of special ops there and drones, he will deal and promote democracy. Remember his Cairo speech. Wow, I mean, that would have been Woodrow Wilson type of speech. Wonderful. But he ended up what happened now, support militarily the Saudis bombing the Yemenis and killing over 1,000 civilians and wounding tens of thousands of people. He ended up supporting a corrupt dictator, al-Sisi, in Egypt. And we made a mess, and he was partner in making a mess in Libya. So he's really, I mean, his legacy is going to be horrible. And his youthfulness is, unfortunately, his inexperience, as shown in the G7 when he said, we have no strategy. Well, even I don't believe there is no strategy. This is his strategy. He will not send troops, or he will send just few, and hopefully you wouldn't notice. And he will muddle through until his term is over, and he will collaborate with these dictators. What we should make out of that? And now what they are saying, after all the mess we have created, they think there is a cheap way of doing it, and that is, let's divide Iraq into three regions. Well, why would you think dividing Iraq into three regions is going to work and be peaceful, where the whole invasion with 160,000, 70,000 troops didn't work? It's going to be worse mess. And this is why the Republicans are being really evildoers. They want to give directly the weapons to the Sunnis. Guess what will happen? They will immediately declare a country. Now with Iraq in effect. And I'm sure all of you have read, the Department of Defense actually has a plan to divide Iraq in three pieces.
So, Imara, let me get your take on what I said, my mini analysis there.
I mean, I think that you are essentially right, but I also think that you're right about every major problem that the United States has ever confronted. The issue with the presidency and the reason why it's there and the reason why it has power concentrated in itself as an executive is because what arrives on the desk of the president and the things that the president is tasked to do are things that no one else in the government could solve. Perhaps even no one in the world could solve. And we can pick any administration from the situation that Roosevelt found himself, you know, when he entered office in 1933 to the economic mess that Bill Clinton had when he came into office in 1992. The problems start out with no plans, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a way to address them. That doesn't mean that there are not resolutions. That doesn't mean that there isn't a way forward. What has to happen is that there has to be a serious amount of engagement and brain power and smart work on the part of administrations to address problems well. And so I think that your starting point is true, but I don't think that that in and of itself is enough to give a pass for us not developing or having a plan, because we would never do anything. The government would be paralyzed and frozen because all of the issues are really complicated and are really hard and don't seem to have at the beginning a resolution.
So you know, before we get to break here, I mean, I think that there are something that was really interesting to me as I was reading about it and following it, that so much focus in the beginning on Russia. And one of the things that struck me is they talked about Russia, the keeping the sanctions against Russia because of Russian activity in Ukraine. Of course, the West doesn't talk about its own activity in the Ukraine or the complexities of that. But they also talked about that, and then there was also some conversations about China. And what really struck me was that these two sectors of the world right now, what's happening between Russia and Western Europe, and China opening up naval bases throughout the South Pacific, and the confrontations verbally between the United States and China over these things, that we are, I think, dangerously on the brink of something larger than ISIS, something larger than all the other crises we face, if we keep pushing to the brink with China and Russia. And I think, Otto, that's something that we don't pay enough attention to. Otto?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, both of you. But go ahead, Otto. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. I think you're right. The major issues don't come up in G7. I think that there is I presume there has to be some confidential conversation about these issues, what to do with China and Far East Asia, and how to deal with Russia. I think what you hear is only the tip of an iceberg, and hopefully it will mollify everyone.
But one of the problems in all of these is that the way a big way that international affairs, there are 190 countries on the face of the planet, and a good portion of them have a lot of influence, probably a group of 40 or 50, have a lot of influence on the world. There's no way that, you know, the United States is in constant communication with every single one about what's happening or what's not. And so a large way in which people judge, just like, you know, just like in a household, people in a household or in a family, the way that you judge what is allowed and what isn't allowed often is through what's something called signaling. And signaling is basically that your behavior is consistent when you are confronted with a series of similar circumstances. So people understand, well, if I do X, then generally this is the way that the United States will respond. And one of the problems is that our signaling has been so off, that we've been really inconsistent for a while now in terms of matching our words and our deeds with our actions. Sometimes we say that we're interventionists and then we don't intervene. And then other times we say we're not going to do something. And then we seem to unleash a series of actions, such as now our third war in Iraq, where we have mission creep. And so the problem is that no one around the world really can judge what the actions of the United States are going to be, which means that people then begin to test the international system to see what they can get away with. And that's what's happening in Russia. And that's what's happening right now in the South China Sea. The problem is that people don't believe what the United States says. And that's because that's because we're not matching our actions consistently with our words. Now, some people can hear that and say, oh, well, that's an argument for interventionism. No, it actually means that you just have to be really clear about what you care about and what your lines are. So when there's something that you don't really care about, if you don't really care about chemical weapons in Syria, then don't say that you are serious about it. And then when it comes to take action on it, you don't. And if you say that you're not going to get involved in a place like Libya, but then end up leading and coordinating an international bombing campaign, and then decide that you're going to lead the political process afterwards to go its own way and then create a safe haven for ISIS, then that creates confusion. And so what there has to be is a consistency of thought and action, so that there are not these major tests to the international system. And we don't have that right now.
So we're talking, I have to get a very short break here. I'll let you come right back, and then we'll go to the phones and bring Clarence in, who's called in, and introduce our third guest, who's coming on as well after the break. We have to take a short break and come right back for some station ID. On the way to break, we're hearing House Carpenter by Gene Ritchie, who passed away at 92 last week, the mother of modern folk music. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I could have married a king's daughter fair, and she would have married me.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, rolling high and mighty traps.
Pops. That's My Back Pages, Bob Dylan, from one of the great albums he ever did. Another side of Bob Dylan, some of the great poetry put to music, recorded on this day in 1964. We are here with Imara Jones, host of Caffeine TV and an online daily news brief. He served in the Clinton White House, where he worked in international trade policy and was an executive at Viacom. Dr. Adil Shamu is with us still, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, a senior analyst in Foreign Policy and Focus, author of Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace, and he blogs at waronpeace.com, which you should go to and read. David Turnbull joins us now. He is campaign director for Oil Change International. And David, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us as well.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Since a big piece of this G7 summit has to do with climate, before we get to that, let me let Adil have the say what he's going to, that you were about to comment on what Imara said. When I raised the larger issue about Russia and China, and then we'll go to the phones and come back to David Turnbull.
Yeah, I want to take a slightly different take on the clarity. I think he proposed that if we say we're going to go to Syria, or if we do this and we don't do it or do it, then the world doesn't know. You're right in general. However, throughout the history, there are clear-cut issues where you will go to war if necessary for them. But there is a huge gray zone area, and that gray zone area is intentionally left there because we don't know. We don't know which one of these we could take a piece of it. And that's really what's operative now. With China, for example, they are testing that gray zone area. We never said if you build an artificial island there, we're going to go to war with you, or we're going to come and our planes will fly over it. And they were testing the gray zone area. There are a lot of gray zone are kept there. And in my view, throughout the history, these were the ones who the two powers, or three, four, five powers, the empires, divvied them up in such a way that there was no war. And that's why I think that historically the gray zone area in foreign policy or in a strategic competition, it will stay there.
Let me get a phone call in here, and I want to kind of talk a bit about the climate change aspect of what happened here, as well as all the other subjects. We'll get to Greece and more. 410-319-8888, and some interesting commentary from around the world we want to look at as well. I mean, I found interesting how places like the Hindu Times refer to this, to the G7. I'll just throw this out here for you all to think. They called it the summit of the wealthiest democracies. And that their analysis went from there. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Clarence in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner. I don't want to oversimplify this, but, you know, look at the mindset behind American foreign policy, which is Russia must never be able to rise in status and power to challenge American interests anywhere in the world. And that includes China. It's written in the Wolfowitz Doctrine. And that is the mindset behind American foreign policy anywhere in the world. Look at the Black Sea, Russia's Black Sea port in the Ukraine. They're not going to relinquish that. It would be the equivalent of America giving up Annapolis, the Annapolis Naval Base. So when you look at what's happening there, just look at the foreign policy and the mindset behind it. That includes China or anybody else in the world rising to a status where it can challenge American interests. Thank you, Mr. Stein.
Thank you, Clarence. I think that the G7 has drawn some lines, but we'll see where those what's going to tumble out in the next few months, both in terms of Ukraine and China, and even Greece, which we haven't touched on yet, which we need to touch on. We will do so in a few minutes. This was a very interesting summit. That just in terms of what it laid down, one of the things it did lay down was saying that by 2100, the year 2100, that we're going to free ourselves from fossil fuels. David Turnbull, let me turn to you first and your thoughts on what that really meant. I was that date kind of shocked me a little bit.
Yeah, sure. You know, when JFK announced that we were going to get to the moon in a decade,
right?
The thing about that announcement was that it was ambitious both in terms of the content but also the timeline. Unfortunately, the G20 is relatively ambitious here on the content. Decarbonizing our economy is absolutely essential. Unfortunately, they're not ambitious on the timeline. If we're decarbonizing our economy by 2100, our planet is going to be cooked. We need to be doing that in a much faster time frame, and they need to be setting goals at a much earlier on to really set us on a course for a safe climate. So, you know, really excited to see this concept of decarbonizing, of getting ourselves off of fossil fuels as a planet. That's great, and that's something that we're very excited to see that concept really be, solid and embraced by the G7 leaders. But unfortunately, that timeline is just simply far too long.
Well, and let me talk about the complexity of this for a minute. And Mara, I can start with you and go to Adil and back to David. I was thinking about the call for an end to be relying on carbon economy here for the planet by 2100 that the German Prime Minister Merkel stated, but that this is a complex thing because A, you've got the developing world that is using carbon-based materials because they want to catch up to the rest of the world. You've got, though, an international capital, for want of a better term, embedded in the oil industry that is getting its way throughout the world. It's getting its way here in America with President Barack Obama, where most of the money we're putting in and opening up public lands for oil exploration and becoming an exporter of oil and gas and becoming our own kind of economic power around oil and gas. Yet at the same time, we're talking about not relying on it. Yet a lot of our policy is shifted in that direction. So I see a lot of, hearing what they were saying at the G7, but I see a lot of contradictions here.
Yeah, I think, this is the kind of the theme that we're talking about, which is a lack of consistency kind of across the board. I actually think that this is, once again, that's something that's really, really clear. It's really clear, at least since Kyoto, that there's a global consensus on how we're supposed to handle climate change, that climate change is reversible, that humans are causing it, that if we do certain things, we can actually avoid a tipping point where our planet isn't inhabitable for us. Other life will continue, but we won't. And that, as was said before, 2100 just won't cut it. And the interesting thing is that we actually know with existing technology how to curb climate change and continue to have a growing economy. As a matter of fact, I think the Rocky Mountain Institute published a report, I think probably 4 or 5 years ago, detailing how we could have by 2050 an economy that was twice as large as we had 4 years ago in 2010, 2011, but use the exact same amount of carbon using existing technology that was in existence then. The problem is that this gets muddy because there's a large international corporate pushback against these changes changes, largely by the fossil fuel industry, which for the past 100 years has been the most powerful industries and the largest in the world that has not changed since their existence. And so, it once again is about consistency and engagement, but this is pretty clear. There's been a consistency here and a consensus for almost three decades now.
And even within that, Adil, you had Japan and Canada a little reluctant to sign on to start with, even with this theoretical notion.
Well, even Merkel, she wants to change it to temperature rise rather than on carbon. And again, my colleague may be more expert than I am. And temperature rise is a late indicator. It will be too late almost by the time the temperature rises.
That's right.
David, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so the sort of inconsistency that you were talking about and that the other guests were talking about, one of the places that we see it most strongly is the fact that these G7 countries are subsidizing fossil fuels. So they are saying on the one hand that we need to get off of these fossil fuels in the very long term. But on the other hand, they're spending our public money on billions of dollars going towards support for fossil fuels. We put out a report earlier this year that looks precisely at the amount of money just going from G7 countries to support coal. Coal is, the worst of the worst of fossil fuels. And they're spending billions of dollars, over $9 billion a year in public finance for coal projects around the world.
Is this the G7 collectively you're talking about?
Yeah, G7 collectively, okay. as G7 countries. Collectively, they're spending billions of dollars a year to support with public finance coal projects around the world, in developing countries, in countries around the world, while they're saying that we need to be moving off of fossil fuels. So there is a lot of inconsistency here, and that's why we feel that it's fantastic to see a long-term goal. We think the timeline's too long, but it's great to see goals that are sort of ambitious and out there. But really, when the rubber hits the road, we need to see action now. And one of the first steps that countries can take is to stop funding with our public finance these fossil fuels and stop subsidizing them.
So I wonder what we think this G7 summit really, what it comes down to, what it really means. And let me add another piece in here. I mean, Merkel also talked about ending, I've got to find the exact wording here. She didn't say ending world hunger, but she used to turn the man to hunger that's not so bad as it is now. I'll find that. I apologize. I said that right in front of me. But when you talk about the fighting poverty, when you talk about no fossil fuels after 2100, and not having a strategy with ISIS and going to confront Russia to what they do, it seems to me that the subtext of all this G7 summit was, I don't know what to do. I have no plan, but here's a great idea.
The issue here, though, is that, as I said before, the G7 and all of these institutions are American creations. They are tools to advance American foreign policy. And when there's not strong leadership from the United States, it's very difficult to get a consistent and a clear program, which is why sort of delegating the coordination of this to the Germans, doesn't make any sense, because there is only one power that has the cross-cutting leverage across all these countries to be able to coordinate them. And that's been true from the beginning. And so a part of this is a reflection of our own policy confusion and our own policy inconsistency across the board. Not only that there is difficulty in getting everyone together on one page globally, that's always been the case, but I think this is much more a story about the United States right now.
It may be about the U.S., Adil, and it's also, though, it seems to me that there are so many major crisis points on the planet right now, and a lack of unity that might have existed between 50 years ago, even if it existed then. But there are lots of great platitudes being thrown out at G7, but not a lot of substance.
Well, I don't expect them to have a great deal of detailed substance. In these meetings, it's more mission/vision or vision/mission type, what they want to see the world go in what direction. And from it, eventually some substance material will evolve. So I don't expect them to solve the world's problem, whether it's in the Middle East or with China issue or with Ukraine. I don't think they're solvable at this time, and not within the next decade they won't be solved. So, the Western countries, especially the European countries, they're barely surviving. I mean, they're doing well, they think, but they're really, on world stage, they're barely surviving as members of the world stage. The powerhouses, the United States, China, and then you have the rising powers again of the Soviet Union. Russia and Brazil, etc. European Union is going to disappear. I mean, it's going to be weakened as we go on with issues we didn't speak about. Greece issues and splitting of the England from the European Union. David Cameron boxed himself in promising to have a referendum.
Right.
I think the referendum is going to pass, a split up from the European Union.
Now, I'm going to come right back to that, what you just said, Alex. I'm going to hit that theme that you just brought up. But David Turnbull, I know your focus is on climate, so let me come back to that for a moment. When they talk about, the G7 talks about decarbonizing the global economy in the course of the century, as Ms. Merkel said. I don't sound like a pessimist, but I'm not sure what that means. I mean, even how they even think they're going to get there.
Sure. You know, I think, you know, as I said, the first step is really to stop funding the stuff that you're trying to get off of.
But what would happen if they did that tomorrow?
Well, I think, you know, you'd see a rise in renewable energy in a way that, we may not be seeing right now because of such an uneven playing field. So, you know, there are many studies out there. Mark Jacobson is a great example of somebody who's really putting out some really amazing work that shows that we can get off the fossil fuels and power on our economy with renewable energy, with no carbon. And that's something that we need to be striving for. When you look at the climate crisis that's out there, you know, I'm based in California, and we're still experiencing one of the worst droughts in the history. And these are things that are happening today. And so, you know, we need to have an ambitious vision of what this world can look like. And, you know, with respect to the discussion earlier around what the G7 means, you know, in the climate context, the United Nations is really the place where a global agreement needs to take place, because it will incorporate the poorest countries, the most vulnerable countries, into that agreement to ensure that they're protected. But what the G7 can do is show that these rich countries that have some of the most historic responsibility for the climate crisis, as well as the most sort of resources to actually do something about it, are serious. They can show that by taking immediate steps now to eliminate subsidies, to transition their economies, like some of them are doing, towards more renewables, et cetera, and show that they're going to support those developing countries to do the same as well. They're not going to be left on a lurch. They're not going to be left to fend for themselves. But rather, we're going to get together on this and work together to find that safer and more climate-friendly future. You know, I think it's out there. I think it's a vision that a lot of people have, and that there are reports out there that show that it can be done.
And it probably, I think it can be, most of us think it can be done. I think the people you mentioned, the programs you've had about this before, many shows over the years. But I think that what people don't really get to, Amara, a lot is, and G7 doesn't get to it either, is how you actually do the transition. You know, I mean, you're talking about an entire planet that is a carbon-based economy.
Yes, but you do it through, it's how you turn the battleship on a lot of really complex issues. You structure a time to roll out certain subsidies and to change the incentive, to change the incentive structure. And so what would happen is that over a period of time, there would be less subsidies for fossil fuels. There would be, over time, larger taxes for carbon, and there would be incentives, tax relief, to switch faster to renewables. And if you do that, if you have a 10 or a 20 year plan to do those things in concert, this is an entirely fixable problem. And of course, a part of the formula as well is to make sure that we have transfer payments to be able to make sure that developing countries can begin to implement these new technologies. And you do that by diverting a part of the taxes on carbon and the money that you save in part on not subsidizing fossil fuels over time to developing countries. So again, this is we've done this before on a lot of complicated issues involving the environment, pollution of air, pollution of water, all of the rest of it. So we know how to do it. The question is about our ability to be able to mobilize to do it. And that's what the G7 and other four like it are really important in doing.
So, and I'd let me come back to a piece that we talked about a moment ago. Try to get back to climate before we end the hour. But you raised the issue of Britain and Greece, and the European Union, and I think also many of our listeners we don't follow this a great deal, don't understand the severity of what's about to happen, because Greece is really battling to try to control their economic situation on their terms, not Europe's terms, and no agreement has come to yet. And Britain is going to have a referendum, and knowing how Britain has been going recently, that referendum could very well vote itself out of the European Union. And what that would mean in terms of kind of an unraveling.
I just want to make one comment on our previous discussion.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah, sure.
That's all right. I think it's going to depend a great deal of the change to non-fossil fuel. It's innovation. And if innovation doesn't happen, the transition is going to be very, very difficult, and the developing countries will suffer a great, great deal. Now we could go back to England.
But can I just say that really quickly? The technology revolution has changed. We can make this transition right now with existing technology. That's been the case for the past 5 years. This is no longer an argument about technology. That's a ruse that's used by the other side to continue to the way that we do business now, which is harming the planet. We have the technology that we need to make this transition.
Well, we don't have the technology to change the food habits all across the world yet. We still eat cows, for example, which I love the steak, eat cows, which require so much energy and water and expenditure of a great deal of carbon just to process, and the plants, etc. So that's a huge part of the fossil fuel.
I know, but before we jump back to Adel, since we raised it once again, David, I'm sure you have a quick thought on this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issues around how we produce our food and agriculture are huge, and they're very important. But as Amara was saying, there are a lot of steps that we can take immediately today that can put us on a trajectory that's actually going to be compatible with having a safe climate. Yes, there are going to be challenges that we need to confront as we move forward, agriculture being a big one, and land use overall. But in our energy sector, which is the vast majority of fossil fuels, I mean, of emissions, we can move forward today. And that's an important point and will set us on that trajectory that we need to get on.
So, let me come back again to where I just want to get a thought.
Sure.
We were trying to get to the point, but this is really, really important. The climate change piece, I think, is one of those critical pieces of this G7. But the unraveling, I mentioned that between Greece and Europe and Britain on either ends of the continent here.
Yes. Well, Greece is really fighting for its survival, and the G7 and the West is trying to straddle them such that will keep the middle class and the poor poorer and less middle class. And that's really what they're facing. They are facing truly an economic existential threat to them. And I don't know how it's going to be resolved. And if they get out of the whole Western nation circle, is going to be very serious in terms of Europe, in terms of world peace, and may strengthen Putin and China, especially Putin, because there are some hints that they may go and get some help from Russia or China.
Can I just say something about Greece really quickly?
Uh-huh.
I think it's really important for us to remember that the principle isn't about the changes that Greece wants, because Greece is actually asking for really marginal changes. They're asking to go from from 3.5% to from 4.5%, a reserve fund that they have to set aside, mandated by the European Union. They want to take that money and make the cuts that they have to make across the board less painful. And they're asking that this, that in part, this be done by an extension of just 1 year, their payment schedule. So Greece isn't talking about defaulting. They don't want to leave the euro. They don't want to collapse the European Union. They're asking for a minor adjustment. The issue here is that Germany and the Germans in particular don't want to play, because they say that if we set a principle of not having Greece play by the rules, then what does it mean for everyone who else that's that has done? And the trouble in this is that maybe in the midst of these principle arguments, as you're pointing out, what might happen is that Greece, is that the circumstance ends up being created where Greece does end up leaving, which is what no one wants right now. I mean, the bet right now is that they'll find a way through it. They've been muddling through this crisis since 2009 with the possibility of a Greek exit. So they'll probably come to some accommodation. But it's a larger issue here of there being a divorce between actions and principles. And that's what we've been talking about for the last hour. And the same is true for Britain. Britain doesn't want to leave the European Union. There's no way that David Cameron wants to be the last prime minister, both of Great Britain due to a Scottish exit, or to have Britain leave the European Union. Britain would cease to exist as a major global power if it does so. But again, you have this divorce between reality, these principles, and what is happening on the ground. And the same is true there.
I just wanted to get this thing I said earlier, and I couldn't think of the quote, and I just found it. That now this is jumping around a bit, but I want you to throw this out here. The German leader said, Merkel said, was they want to find a way to have initiatives to work for an end to extreme poverty. So I mean, this is all kind of part and parcel of them trying to put their hands around what is in some ways is coming apart, and they're trying to figure out ways to put it back together before it does come apart. I hate to sound so negative and pessimistic about it, but that just in following all this is the way it feels where it's going. But we have like 2 minutes left. I'm just going to get some very quick closing thoughts from our guests literally in 2 minutes. David Turnbull?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the G7 agreement this year was, I think, both about as much as we could have expected them, but also not enough and not fast enough. It was a good signal that we're moving in the right direction in terms of the substance and in terms of this idea and realization that we need to move off of fossil fuels. But it was really, you know, scary to think that these leaders are not willing to move fast enough. As we lead into a very large international negotiations in Paris at the end of this year,
right,
the hope is that these countries can take some really concrete steps between now and then to ensure that Paris can be successful and that we enter 2016 on a new path towards a climate-safe future.
And I actually thought we had more time than we have. We have like 30 seconds left, so I just want to thank you all for being part of this. It's been a great discussion from myriad perspectives. David Turnbull, Campaign Director for Oil Change International, thank you so much for being here. Great to have you on the show. Dr. Adil Shamu, from fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies, senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus. Adil, always good to have your voice here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And same to Amara Jones. Always great to have him on the air, host of Caffeine TV, who is a real thinker about our national and international issues. Amara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And thank you all for listening in and calling in and making the show what it is every day here on the Mark Steiner Show. That is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our engineering intern is Anthony Nichols. Our intern and day in history producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And we're here in Caravan by the great Les Paul, who was born on this day in 1915. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.